You're listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast series. Thinking for Yourself by Gregory Salmieri.
So this is a talk on thinking for yourself, part of a topic of a conference and the first talk in a conference on individualism versus tribalism. So let me say a bit about this difference first, this distinction between individualism and tribalism, this opposition, and then how thinking for yourself relates to it. If you think of individualism as a term, the normal contrast to it, really the proper or direct contrast to it, is collectivism. And tribalism is a sort of collectivism, maybe a perspective on collectivism. But what is this broader conflict between individualism and collectivism? What are these two views? Well, I think the way to think about it is to start with thinking about human beings and what a human being is. So here I am, I'm a human being. I exist, and I'm made up of a lot of parts. I have organs, systems of organs, cells that comprise the organs, that make up tissues, and then the tissues comprise the organs. So I'm made up of a lot of smaller components that work together to be the organism that I am. And I, too, factor into larger wholes composed of groups of people. I'm a member of a family. I live in a certain city. I'm a member of various organizations that I work for as an employee or as a board member or as, I'm just involved in various groups. I'm part of this conference, right? Which of these levels, the individual human being, the cells, the organs, the family, the race, I guess that's a group I'm part of, the country, the whole of the human race, which of these levels is the primary one that you need to think about to understand what I am and to evaluate me? And which do I need to be focusing on to evaluate myself, to decide what to do? Most people who've given the matter serious thought have recognized that if you want to understand my organs and cells and biological systems, to determine why they are as they are and act as they do and what would be good for them and whether they are good, one has to start by recognizing them as components of the whole organism and to realize that my liver is as it is and has the features it does and should be or shouldn't be as it is if it's in a healthy or unhealthy state because of the role it plays in my life as a whole. So our organs are essentially parts of us. My organs are essentially parts of me. But what about me? Is there some larger whole, some community, some collective of people to which I stand as my kidneys stand to me? Or rather, such that to understand what I am and to evaluate me, you need to think about me as a piece, a fragment, an organ of this larger collective? Or rather the reverse. Am I an individual to be understood primarily as an individual, and my role in any larger group that I might be a part of to be understood as in the context of that first prior understanding of my individuality? What am I essentially, an individual or a part of a collective? Individualism is the theme of this conference. It's a premise of my talk rather than something I'm going to defend here. But let me just remind us all of why individualism is true. And I think we're going to have a lecture by Harry Binswanger later on free will, which I think is a really essential point here. But just let me remind you of why it is that human beings are individuals. Because we live by thought, and thinking is individualistic. And since it's the anniversary year of The Fountainhead, let me read a quote from that novel on that we can keep in mind as a background for everything else we're going to discuss. "Man cannot survive except through his mind. He comes on earth unarmed. His brain is his only weapon. Animals obtain food by force. Man has no claws, no fangs, no horns, no great strength of muscle. He must plant his food or hunt it. To plant, he needs a process of thought. To hunt, he needs weapons, and to make weapons, a process of thought. From this simplest necessity to the highest religious abstraction, from the wheel to the skyscraper, everything we are and everything we have comes from a single attribute of man, the function of his reasoning mind. But the mind is an attribute of the individual. There is no such thing as a collective brain. There is no such thing as a collective thought. An agreement reached by a group of men is only a compromise or an average drawn upon many individual thoughts. It is a secondary consequence. The primary act, the process of reason, must be performed by each man alone. We can divide a meal among many men. We cannot digest it in a collective stomach. No man can use his lungs to breathe for another man. No man can use his brain to think for another. All the functions of the body and spirit are private. They cannot be shared or transferred. And this idea that everything we have and everything we are is due to the function of reason, and reason is an attribute of the individual. No one can do another person's thinking. That is the essence of individualism, at least Ayn Rand's brand of individualism and the individualism that we're forms a premise for this conference and that we're going to be thinking about. Individualism as contrasted with collectivism, the idea that everything we are and everything that we have comes from some larger group to which we belong. But what of tribalism in particular? Well, there are all different kinds of larger groups, collectives, that you might think an individual belongs to, that you might try to subordinate the individual to. The family, the nation, the race, all of humankind. What's special about tribes that gives rise to this idea of tribalism in particular? Well, first of all, tribe has a kind of connotation of primitiveness, right? You think of tribes of people rather than nations, rather than full developed societies. And there are two things I want to point out in that connection relevant to our thinking of tribalism. First of all, tribes are one of a number of competing tribes. You don't just have one tribe. There's tribes that are always one of several in opposition to each other. You could have, at least in theory, a type of collectivism in which all of humankind is one big harmonious collective that we're working for the good of, as opposed to my collective versus someone else's collective, which are in opposition. So for this more benevolent, universalist kind of connectivism, think of the John Lennon song, Imagine, where he imagines a future where all of mankind will live as one, not one over here in opposition to the one over there, but all of mankind, right? As opposed to Marxism, which the Communist Manifesto begins by talking about how all of history has been a history of class struggle, right? One group against another. Think tribalism includes, over and above collectivism, the idea of collectives in contrast, in conflict with one another. And the other thing that it includes is the idea that the collectives are formed not by shared ideas, not by a bunch of people who got together because of their minds, because of some conclusion they reached that brought them together into this group, as we're maybe all brought here by certain conclusions we've reached, but rather by factors like who they were born to, where they were born, what language they were taught as a young person, by accidental, often perceptual level, historical factors. There may be many ideas that are shared by a tribe, but those ideas aren't what holds the tribe together. They're sort of pieties or totems that are repeated in the group and kind of you're expected to bow to, but you're not in the group first and foremost because of your allegiance to certain ideas. Rather, the ideas are seen as something you ought to subscribe to, you ought to mouth, you ought to follow because you're part of this group and these ideas are what people around here in this group say. The group is held together by accidental factors and by loyalties. Loyalties to the individuals, to the history, not loyalties to an idea. And I think this fact brings a way in which you can contrast individualism and tribalism directly, rather than just thinking of tribalism as a species of this brighter thing, collectivism. The idea is when you face reality, when you do your thinking, are you thinking for yourself about what's true? And then maybe joining up and combining with other people in various groups because of the conclusions you reach and the goals you form because of those conclusions, and then noticing other people having formed similar goals based on similar conclusions, and you think we can work together, where our togetherness is posterior to our thinking, is based on our thinking and the values we formed on it. Or are you on the premise we go together as opposed to them, and then the ideas that you hold follow from that group membership or that unity. And the title of this conference is Individualism in an Age of Tribalism. And I think we are in an age of tribalism. It is not the case that if you look at our culture broadly, and you'll see this, I think, in a lot of the talks later today, that there are groups of people united by ideas, that our society is in a conflict of groups of people organized around different ideas and arguing back and forth. We are in a period of tribalism. And you can see that if you think about the dominant factions in politics, the so-called left and the so-called right. If you think about all the things that the right has in common that they're interested in today, various religious positions like being anti-abortion and being anti-gay, various nationalist and protectionist positions which have come to dominate recently, anti-trade, anti-immigrant, anti what they call globalists, also being for gun rights, also thinking the family is super important, also having some vague remnants of an interest in capitalism and so wanting lower regulations and lower taxes and being semi-quasi almost pro some industries and now being anti-establishment. And then you think of the contrary positions associated with the left, being environmentalist, being advocates of various groups that they see as persecuted and disadvantaged in various ways, racial, gender groups, sexual minorities, and so forth, being for labor unions, being attracted to socialism, also being anti-establishment. There's nothing that holds everything on the left side together as opposed to everything on the right side together, or there's no reason why all the positions on the right should belong together as opposed to the positions on the left, other than accidental sociological factors, that these things happen to get grouped together by certain groups. And you can see that by the fact that they change over time. Like at one point, being in favor of women having the right to vote went along with wanting to ban alcohol. Now those things have nothing to do with one another, right? And if you look at what does unite everything on the, all the people on the right, what all the people moved by these different considerations, and one person may be moved by several of them, have in common, it's really primarily opposition to the left. And likewise, if you look at people on the left and think about what do they have in common, it's opposition to the right. If you think of the right that as something that includes everything from the church preacher who's concerned about family values to the Klansmen concerned about the white race being diminished to the members of the Better Business Bureau, what do all these people have in common that makes them think of themselves as on the right? They really hate and are worried about the people on the left, who they think are worse than any of the other ones in their coalition. And likewise, if you go to the person who's a strong defender of abortion rights, and the person who is a member of a Antifa black bloc, and the person who is a democratic socialist, what do they all have in common when those positions really have well, the socialism and the black bloc does, but not that much to do with each other. Well, again, it's thinking the right is the menace. And these are tribes that are opposed to each other as tribes. And I think that's the situation that we're in politics now. People united by group loyalties and the premise that the other group is the problem, not by ideas. And it's in that context that we want to think for ourselves and think about what thinking for ourselves means, how it's different from being a part of this. So let me start by talking about a kind of argument. It's a logical fallacy at all times and comes up in different contexts. But I think it's very dominant today and it very much contributes to tribal thinking. And then by contrast to that, I'm gonna talk about a little bit about what genuine thinking implies and kind of gives us an orientation to the kind of premises you have to be on if you're actually thinking for yourself. The fallacy I want to talk about is what Ayn Rand calls the argument from intimidation. And she has an essay by that title in The Virtue of Selfishness where she describes it. Basically, it's the fallacy of substituting a moral condemnation of an idea for an argument directed against it. So you advance a certain idea, I could argue against the idea, but instead I say, you think that? What kind of a person would think that? You must be and here's the pattern of the argument, only those who are evil, dishonest, heartless, insensitive, ignorant, etc., can hold such an idea. I dismiss you for holding the idea. I dismiss the idea just by a moral condemnation of it, not by saying what's wrong with it. It is, as Rand puts it, a method of bypassing logic by means of psychological pressure. And I think this kind of psychological pressure works and functions by assuming that we have certain shared values. And particularly if you think of the kinds of things that are used in these kinds of arguments, often by associating you, who I want to smear, with the other group, the other tribe that we're opposed to. Now, before I talk a little bit more about this and how we see it in our culture now and how to fight it if you feel yourself being pulled into this kind of argument, I want to correct a possible implication that you shouldn't morally judge ideas, because you should. As Rand puts it, moral evaluations are implicit in most intellectual issues. It is not morally merely permissible, but mandatory to pass moral judgment when and where appropriate. And to suppress such judgment is an act of moral cowardice. But, and here's the essential point, a moral judgment must always follow, not precede or supersede, the reasons on which it is based. So again, like you think first, reach conclusions, and then join whatever groups might help you advance those conclusions, you think first and form evaluations based on the reasons for and against a view, and the reasons to think the view is first true and therefore good, or to think the view is false and therefore bad, not letting assumptions that you hold or take over about whether the view is good or bad, righteous or vicious, appropriate or inappropriate, stand in for in the place of your thinking. Not substituting a moral condemnation for an argument against the idea. And Rand points out that this argument from intimidation often takes the form of a sneering or, you know, a kind of way you mention, you're not a blankist, you're not a thisist, oh, that's a such and such idea, a kind of tone of dismissal or condemnation. And let me give a list of a lot of things we might call someone scornfully based on his ideas. And you see these a lot. And I've put up a list that includes terms that are mostly used by the left, mostly used by the right to dismiss the other, some you find on both sides. Some of these, I think, denote things that are really immoral or evil. Some of them denote things that are neutral and some that are good, but they all have in common that they're used this way. That view's extremist, that you're not a racist, are you? If you think that, you'd have to be a misogynist. Only a globalist would think such and such. Are you you're not a climate change denier. Are you so ignorant as to suppose such and such? It would be unpatriotic to think that such and such can be the case. That's anti-American, it's uncaring. Don't be a victim blamer or a xenophobe or a homophobe or a transphobe or an Islamophobe or don't be a phobe of something. Don't be a socialist. He's a socialist, a communist, a collectivist, a fascist, an anti-vaxxer, a cuck. That's just fake news. It's privileged to think that. It's elitist. That's something the alt-right holds. Don't be a right-winger or a left-winger. Now, I think you shouldn't be an alt-rightist or a right-winger or a left-winger, and a lot of these other things I think are really bad. But notice that they can function either as something that you've reached a reasoned conviction that there's something wrong here, and then this is your name for that wrong thing, or it can be used if you're talking to someone who is holds a certain position, thinks that position is true, you can try to kind of intimidate him out of it. Try to scare him out of it. You're bad if you hold this by using these terms. And you can feel that pressure inside yourself. And that is not real thinking. That is letting yourself bow to the prejudices or pressures of some group rather than thinking it through. And let me just mention an area in which I think we saw a lot of this, a particular concrete recently, the controversy over Kavanaugh's nomination. Almost everything I read on this had the tone of, the right answer here is obvious. How we should deal with things are obvious. Some group is just doing it wrong. And you're not one of them, are you? You're not a misogynist who doesn't believe women and engages in victim blaming because you're privileged and entitled and you support or fail to condemn rape culture, the patriarchy, or the old boys club. No, I'm not that. Well, that means you're contributing in the witch hunt, the moral panic, you're involved in a smear campaign against this guy, character assassination, part of an angry mob that's against due process. Now, some of these charges on both sides, I think, have merit. But the point is, so much of the conversation about it was trying to pressure people psychologically, and so much of the rhetoric we heard around it was not geared towards someone who's actually thinking through the issue. So what kind of things would go on in genuine thinking about this case, where this guy's about to be nominated for the Supreme Court, and then it comes to light that some woman accused him of assaulting her many years ago, but there's not much confirming evidence, and we haven't looked into it yet, and so forth. What kind of questions, if you're actually thinking about this, if you care what's true and want to know, would go through your head? How can I tell if this charge is true or likely to be true? How can I tell? Not should I believe women or should I believe this woman or these character assassins on the other side. How can I tell if this is true? If the charge is true, does it matter for this? Would it be grounds to disconfirm? Maybe I don't need to look into whether it's true because it's just not relevant to the decision. Or maybe it is. How do I tell that? Has the charge been raised in an improperly politicized manner, as is often claimed? How would I tell if that's the case? If it has, how relevant is that to how I should now treat the charge? What standards of evidence apply here? Is it that I have to decide whether I can know for certain that he did this, in which case only then should we disconfirm him? Or if there's just the faintest suspicion, is that enough to be against him? Or is somewhere in between? What's the right level? Does it matter? Well, they say it's just a job interview. Well, what would be just in a job interview? How do I tell that? Does his comportment during his testimony bear on whether he should be confirmed? And there are a lot of these other questions, which if you raise them as questions, you can start to think through. And there are disagreements, I mean, even among the people here, about how to answer these questions. But what's really toxic, and what's the argument from intimidation, is when you're trying to grapple with these questions, and instead of helping to answer the questions, instead of giving you material that will help you think through these questions, you get the questioning process, the thinking process being cut off by, well, you gotta believe women. Or on the contrary, well, you can't succumb to this character assassination mob. Posed in such a way as to stop the thinking process. And you can get these questions from other people. You can get them from within yourself when you're not really asking these kinds of questions, but leveling these kinds of charges aimed at disrupting the questioning process. And what thinking for yourself is really to be contrasted with this kind of intimidation tactic method of thinking, a method of thinking that's designed to get back at or put down or refute the other rather than find the truth. And so I think you really have to ask yourself if you want to think for yourself and not be captive to whatever group you happen to be a member of, find yourself attracted to or born into. Are you trying to defend yourself or to find the truth? Are you trying to defend some position, defend your self-esteem, which is in question now, or is challenged by someone who says you're immoral if you think this or do this? Are you trying to defend yourself against some attack like that coming from the outside or for some premise you've internalized? Or are you just trying to find out what's true about an issue? If you are trying to find out what's true, if you care what's true, you have to recognize that knowledge is work. And thinking for yourself is work. And all kinds of tribalism, all kinds of collectivism are ultimately attempts to short-circuit the work that's necessary, to get out of it. Now, I gave a whole talk, and it's available on YouTube, called Thinking Objectively, around this theme of knowledge's work, and I talk about the types of work involved. And I'm just gonna say a little bit here to concretize this theme that knowledge's work. There are two basic components of the work of trying to get to know something. First, there's what we call reduction, that's tracing back the evidence. How can I tell this is true? What were the reasons for this again? And then there's integration, which is connecting it to the other things you know or think you know. Reduction is backward looking. How did I get here? What's the grounds for this? And integration is forward looking. Where can I go cognitively with this idea, supposing it's true? In reduction, you're thinking, how can I tell whether this is true? What else would I need to know that it's true? And do I know these other things? What evidence do I have or can I get for it or against it? And importantly, how sure can I be of it? Is it something I'm certain of that's proven? Is it something that there's no reason to believe at all, and so I shouldn't even consider? Or is it somewhere in between? There's some reason for it, but not enough to be sure. And where do I put it on that list? So part of what you're doing when you're asking questions, when you're thinking, is this work of trying to tell, what is the evidence? How can I evaluate it? How sure can I be of the conclusion based on the evidence? And the other part is then connecting it to other conclusions you formed, other judgments you formed. And this has two functions, right? One is error checking. Is it consistent with the other things I know? Even if you think you have enough evidence to prove something and you would have accepted it, if you find that it's inconsistent with something else that you also think you know, they can't both be true, and you have to, as the characters in Atlas Shrugged say, check your premises. Go back to the reduction phase. Somewhere you must have made a mistake. Where is it? But even apart from error checking, and I think even more importantly, integration is how we come to understand things. By bringing together different things you know, they shed light on and illuminate one another. And you get not just a collection of facts held like a pile discreetly, but a system where each element illuminates the whole. But it's work to form such a system. It's work to check that each of the premises is true. It's work to put them together and see how they form together. And that work consists of asking the kinds of questions we were talking about earlier. And you want to be wary of any attempt to short-circuit that process by substituting in what we think as part of this group, or what you should think as a member of some group that you're a part of, not because of conclusions you've reached, or that you're treating not as something not that you're belonging to because of conclusions you've reached, but as something that somehow supersedes your conclusions and your thinking. I want to close with a few pieces of advice on how to do this and how to think about this. First, you have to make peace with the fact that you don't know everything or even everything important. Now, if knowledge is work, then it takes work to know things. And you have a limited amount of time. You're young. You've only done a limited amount of work so far. And it's perfectly natural and unavoidable that there's a lot you don't know. Even if you're old and have spent a lot of time thinking about it, there's so many things to know, you can't know it all. But if you think you should know things that you don't already know, you're going to be very vulnerable to psychological pressure, arguments from intimidation, the feeling like, well, you're bad and not a good member of your tribe and not a good person if you don't already know that this is a case of victim blaming and it's wrong, or character assassination and it's wrong, or whatever it is. So make peace with the fact that you don't know everything, even everything important. Try to find out the things you can. Recognize it's going to take time and going to take work. Cultivate in doing this the innocence of the child in The Emperor's New Clothes. Ayn Rand talks about The Emperor's New Clothes, that story being the kind of paradigm of an argument from intimidation. People go, oh, his clothes are so beautiful even when he's naked, because they're told that to not see the beautiful clothes is a mark of their own evil. And the child at the end of the story who mocks the emperor and points out that he's naked isn't doing it as an act of defiance. Oh, I'm going to stand up to them. He's doing it from a place of innocence. He's just, those kinds of considerations of am I good enough are not present in his mind at all, and therefore not superseding his own judgment. And you want to cultivate that kind of innocence when you think about questions, who to vote for, what's going on with the climate, whatever it is. Is selfishness good or bad? Well, how can I tell? Put aside the issue of am I good or bad for thinking this. What would it say about me that I thought this? Two more pieces of advice, I think. First, view people and sources, value people and sources who recognize the work that's involved in knowing things and try to help you do it. Writers, speakers who approach you as a mind, someone who doesn't know everything already, shouldn't know everything already, is trying to think it through and help you in that process. And disdain people and sources who try to intimidate you for not knowing the things they claim to know already. And do this especially with people you're inclined to agree with. Hold them, hold us, if you're here because you're inclined to agree with us, to a high standard. Beware of monolithic views of competing tribes, claims involving tribal bogeymen like, you know, George Soros or the Koch brothers, jargon and neologisms. Well, I'll leave this for the question here because we're out of time. Test any rhetorical questions that occur to you. If anyone wants to know what I mean by that, ask me. But I want to end with this piece of advice. Be selfish in your criticisms of others. And this is what's really missing from tribal thinking. It's selfless. When you observe a fault in someone else, don't pride yourself on, oh, he's bad, he made this mistake. He's one of them, the leftists or the rightists or the thisists or the thatists, and I can preen myself on being part of the group that's better and doesn't make this mistake. Rather, when you observe a fault in someone else, use it as an opportunity to improve yourself. Here's a mistake people can make. Here's a way in which people go wrong. Do I ever do that? Where might I do it if I did it? Can I check? What kinds of principles or rules or ways of thinking, methods, can I adhere to so that I don't fall into this kind of error? Because I'm concerned with knowing what's true, with making the most of my life, and not with winning, where winning is seen as something you do against the other team that's a loser. Life's not about winning or losing. It's about living and knowing and doing the things you need to succeed in life. Thank you. Okay, we have a short time for questions.
Thank you for your talk. My question is about the terminology left and right, because you know, there's wide usage of these terms, but there's a sense of arbitrariness. If you flipped left and right and just kept the categories, you really wouldn't lose anything. So I'm curious about how you estimate these terms, how useful they are, and if you have a preference in your own usage.
I think of left and right as sociological terms. So there are people, I think this is a mistake, who want to hold on to the idea there's some fundamental political division. Whatever that fundamental political division is, we're going to call one side the left and one side the right. We figure out what the fundamental political division is, and then whatever side I'm on, I call whichever one I used to call myself before I started thinking this way, and I call the other people the other one. So, you know, fundamental, and there are people who do this who think the left is the right one and the right is the right one. But if you think about how these terms have been used in different cultures at different times, it's not clear they're referring to the same division all the time or that they should be. What left and right do, I think, is they take why we have these concepts and need these concepts is that the way cultures work, they tend to, people tend to align themselves into major political factions around whatever issues they, the people in the culture at that time, view as most important, or sets of issues that they group together and view as most important, often in what objectivists would call a package deal fashion, where the issues don't really belong together, and then they oppose each other on these issues. And one needs to do that in a kind of voting process, you know, to form coalitions to win the vote and so forth. So that there should be, in general, two sides in a political process isn't surprising or bad. But if you recognize that there is that thing, that fact sociologically about how societies with voting and such work, and it's not just voting, if they're fighting each other militarily, you have that too. Then you realize that there's a need in any society to notice what the dominant factions are and separate them from one another so that you can just understand sociologically what's going on. And then you can think about each faction in a society, well, what is holding this faction together? And in some cases, there will be really an idea that's holding them together and that's what they're really on about. And so what we call the right or the left in this society is really united by this idea, which is a good or a bad one. But there are lots of cases in which the two dominant factions in a society aren't each united by an central idea on which they differ from the other, but on the fundamental ideas, they're basically the same. And what unites each one together and makes it opposed to the other one is a bunch of accidental factors. On each issue, you might be able to say there's an idea here, but when you think about what holds those issues together, there isn't one. And that's the way I think of the right and left today in America. And also it's the way I think of the libertarian movement, incidentally, today in America. I don't think there's an idea that's holding them together either. These movements are all package deals. They're groups of people and positions that are lumped together for historical, accidental reasons. And then the fact that they're lumped together and seen by the people who hold them as a package opposed to the other package, then influence, and I think influences for the bad, the way the people hold whatever ideas brought them into the package in the first place. So I think the terms right and left are fine, and we should keep using them, but not for political ideologies, but for the cultural phenomenon. Roughly, the right is those people who think the Democratic Party is worse than the Republican Party, and the left is those people who think the Republican Party is worse than the Democratic Party. If you're very right, you think the Republican Party is bad too, because it's too close to the Democrats, and if you're very left, you think the Democrats are bad too, because they're too close to the Republicans, but that's the poll. And so that's how I think about it.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for your talk. And I'm glad that you touched on the package deal fallacy, because I think it's really related to the whole tribalism phenomenon. When I'm talking to certain people and they have this very warped view of certain concepts, or they'll use certain terms which they have an approximation of what they think they mean, but they don't really seem to know what they mean. Like, for example, you touched on the term globalism. Mm-hmm. Another one that I see is corporatism.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
Oh, that was a good one. I should have put that up.
Yeah. So they'll say something like, oh, you see, you're these cronies and they're benefiting from government privilege.
Mm-hmm.
And they take that as a primary, you know, admitting phenomena such as the mixed economy and pressure groups and all that stuff. And so they take that as, well, these corporations are running everything and they don't seem to get the totality of what's actually going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering, how does one objectively look at these things, should we dispense with these terms entirely, or should we try and reframe them in an objective way?
Well, so for each term, I think you have to think about these processes of reduction and integration. Now, you have a whole logic course on how to do this, and I have these lectures on objective thinking. Harry Binswanger taught a series of lectures on logic, I think, that are now up on Ayn Rand campus. So you can, you know, look for, I can only say so much about this right now, but at the most abstract level to describe it, what you do is you think about whatever term it is, and you think, well, why do we need such a term? Mm-hmm. What are the reasons for grouping things together this way? Well, why would this have come about step by step? If I didn't have this term already, what evidence would make me think there's a need to form it? So that's the reduction stage. And you think, well, how good is that evidence? Are these strong reasons to form? And then you think, and then how does it fit in with the rest of what I know? How would it relate to the other concepts I have? Is it a species of one of my other wider concepts, or does it put things together? And you might find there's no evidence for the concept at all, or there is evidence to justify forming it, but only if one holds it and thinks of it in a certain way. And so in the one case you'll reject it, in the other case you'll accept it but hold it in that way. And then when you start to go to relate it to your other concepts, you might notice some contradiction or issue, in which case you will then know you'll have some rethinking to do. One last question, do we have time for? Okay.
Greg. My question is about the left. I'm a subscriber of the Yaman Book Show, and basically Yaman said that the right is motivated by pragmatism and the left is motivated by nihilism. And I definitely see that on the right, because every Yaman and Amy show has pragmatism, so it's concretized for me. But for me, I don't really see how the left is motivated by nihilism, as in I just don't understand that point. So
I don't agree that the right is primarily moved by pragmatism and the left by nihilism. Is that the issue? So I think pragmatism and nihilism are present in a large degree in both sides right now. And I think the real divide in the country on both sides of the political spectrum, pragmatism was totally dominant on both sides from the 70s onward. It was the major force from the 60s onward, but I think there was also a significant nihilist force, a tear it down kind of force with the new left that got kind of battered back. And if you think back from the 70s onward, all the different candidates, there weren't big issues being addressed. It was all kind of wonkish discussions of should this tax be slightly higher or lower, and no principled discussion, all kind of fussing around the details, small stuff. Well, we have to be prudent and careful and so forth, and no real principled thinking. And I think that is what the standard conventional party apparatus of both parties are about. Hillary Clinton is a pragmatist. Kerry was a pragmatist. Mitch McConnell is a pragmatist. All of these people are pragmatists, at least in large measure. But then on both sides, I think there are also nihilists, people who are about tearing things down, who are moved by hatred. I think like the Antifa Black Bloc kind of movement, that kind of tear it down, pull down, not we should remove these statues if we think they're there by an orderly process, but let's go out and tear them down, right, and so forth. There's a lot of that on the left, and it's been on the left as a major force since the new left in the 60s. It was kind of beat back, and now I think it's really risen again. The Occupy movement, I think, is that. And I think a major part of Trump's movement and demographic is nihilism on the right. If you read the article, The Flight 93 Election, the idea that the country is on this course that nothing could be worse than it, and we just have to tear it down and replace it with anything and burn it down, and that kind of a mentality, everything's fake, it's all fake news and so forth, I think is a nihilist mentality on the right now. I think we have both on both sides. And I think the difference between the pragmatists and the nihilists on both sides, both of whom are bad, but the nihilists are a lot worse, is a much bigger difference between the two sides and one another.
Thank you.
Okay, let's thank Greg one more time.
Thanks for listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. You can also find us on YouTube. If you like this content, please share or leave us a review. For more information, go to AynRand.org.